Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing alarm expressed by the White House that the besieged Assad clan in Syria might soon use chemical weapons against their own people. Rafif Jujati, the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, the umbrella group of activists inside of Syria fighting to overthrow the regime, joins us to discuss the likely response if the regime crosses that red line. Then we'll look into the politics of the so-called fiscal cliff following the Republican counteroffer to the president's proposal. Jeff Madrick, who writes a column on economics for Harper's Magazine and is the author of Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America 1970 to the Present, joins us to discuss the absurd theatrics surrounding the phony urgency of going over a mythical cliff while the real issues facing the economy are not being addressed by the press or our politicians. Then finally, we'll discuss Israel's announcement of 3,000 more settlements on the West Bank and Hillary Clinton's appearance at a pro-Israel forum over the weekend where, according to a provocative new article by The New Yorker editor David Remnick, she appeared to be laying the groundwork for a presidential run in 2016. Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, Stephen Walt, joins us to discuss the latest display of fealty to Israel while Prime Minister Netanyahu again pokes America's president in the eye. And joining us now is Rafif Jujati, who is an English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committee, the umbrella group of activists inside of Syria. She's a Syrian and American activist in the Washington, D.C. area and helps organize protests, workshops, and other events designed to empower other activists to take action and inform the public about events inside Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rafif Jujati.
Thank you for having me.
And I know you've been in Syria and in the neighborhood a lot, and you're back in the U.S. So tell us about what's happening now, as much as you understand, with the Free Syrian Army closing in on Damascus, closing the airport there. It does seem as if the Assad regime is under increasing siege, and the U.S. government has now issued grave warnings that they're concerned that the embattled Assad regime may resort to the use of chemical weapons. What's your understanding in terms of, as a Syrian activist, of that possibility?
Well, certainly we have seen the Assad regime moving its chemical weapons around, and we know full well that the regime that has not hesitated to kill upwards of 40,000 people will not hesitate to destroy the entire country and the region as well. But with the Free Syrian Army gains and what we've seen in terms of recent defections, I think we can begin the countdown to the inevitable collapse of the Assad regime. I would say it's on its last legs.
And the defections, of course, a prominent defection just took place with a spokesperson, the government spokesperson for the Syrian Foreign Ministry. That's the latest, right?
Yes, apparently he is now in London, and he has defected. Of course, regime supporters are saying that he was fired for shoplifting several years ago when he was a diplomat in a foreign country. This, again, feeds into the silly rhetoric of the regime. But in addition to Mr. Makdisi's defection, all last week we saw defectors at basically every checkpoint along the road to Damascus International Airport. We've also seen defectors in different parts of Syria, and those defections have greatly helped the Free Syrian Army in liberating checkpoints and air bases.
So, Rafif Jujati, what do we know about the dispersal of these chemical weapons? We know that Syria has the largest chemical arsenal in the Middle East, and it's supposed to be, I've heard figures of 24 sites up to 42 sites. When the U.S. makes these warnings that they're increasingly concerned about the Assad regime resorting to the use of its chemical arsenals against its own people, and today at the White House, the president warned the Assad regime in Syria not to cross that red line. So I guess what's implied here is that, in fact, it's more than implied. The U.S. has earlier said that that is a red line. So if Assad uses these weapons, does that automatically mean the U.S. intervenes?
Well, I would think that if the Assad regime chooses to launch chemical weapons at its own people, This will have ripple effects throughout the region. I believe that once chemical weapons are launched, you really can't contain them or contain their consequences. So I would expect the United States and other members of the international community to take very swift action to prevent as much damage as possible. I also wouldn't be surprised to see a preemptive strike
by the U.S. against what would be the point of blowing up chemical arsenals? I mean, you'd have to secure them, wouldn't you, not blow them up?
I am actually not a chemical weapons expert, so I really couldn't tell you with any degree of accuracy. But I imagine a preemptive strike would be to accelerate the dismantling of the regime as opposed to blowing up installations.
So given that the U.S. has already issued this red line over the use of chemical weapons, and now the U.S. expressing grave concerns that the likelihood of the use is increasing as the Assad regime crumbles and gets more paranoid and more desperate, my understanding is that the Pentagon has done some war games on this, and this may require up to 100,000 U.S. troops to be deployed. And we know that the U.S. public is not happy about any more entanglements in the Middle East. So just practically speaking, what do you think could happen here if that line is crossed?
Well, certainly I've heard talk about contingency plans and different wargaming scenarios on the part of the Pentagon, and I think these had started some time ago. The Assad regime's brutality and unwillingness to find any sort of political solution to this has been well documented throughout the nearly 2 years of revolution. Now, I understand that in the United States there absolutely is no appetite to committing additional troops to yet another war. I'm hoping that it will not come to this, but I think regional allies also need to step up. The Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks have long been making a lot of noise about the Syrian revolution and about their desire for Assad to step down, so perhaps they could also be effective players in the region. Another area of concern or warning to the Assad regime is the fact that Turkey is expected to receive NATO approval to deploy Patriot missiles along its borders with Syria.
Well, but Turkey's basically taken a defensive stance. We're talking about an offensive stance here that would be necessary. You suggested maybe the first foreign intervention involving NATO or the U.S. or both would involve some kind of strike against the regime. My understanding is that way back when Sarkozy was still in power, he and the Saudi defense minister weighed in on the White House, and they wanted to blow up the Assad palace outside of Damascus on the mountain there, and that was vetoed. What's your understanding of what it would take in terms of a preemptive strike against this regime?
Well, I fundamentally believe you take out Assad and his immediate circle of mafioso, and you put an end to three-quarters of the problem in Syria. So, in my mind, a preemptive strike would involve taking out Assad and that small collection of individuals that are making the decisions to kill.
And there would be what? What would be the day after that scenario?
Well, I think the day after, I mean, we can joke about it a little bit. I think the day after will be a lot of celebration across the country. Now, certainly, Syria might experience a period of chaos as we transition. I don't believe there is any transition that is completely clean and not messy. But I think that the will of the Syrian people would have been done, and I think we can move into a democratic state over time. I believe we can implement the rule of law and make sure it applies equally to all citizens. And I know that the average Syrian is moderate, believes in a civil society and a civil state, and does not want to further disrupt our rich cultural and religious heritage.
Again, I'm speaking with Rafif Jujati, who's the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, which is the umbrella group of activists inside Syria. She's a Syrian-American activist in the Washington, D.C. area and helps organize protests, workshops, and other events designed to empower other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. Now, obviously, the Assad regime, its support comes from the Alawite community. My understanding is that they're paranoid and retreating into the northwestern mountain area, you know, for a last stance. So when you say that the day after the Assad's fall, if indeed either the Free Syrian Army takes out the regime or there is a strike on the part of, say, the United States to remove this mafia group, which I think you accurately described them as a mafia family. They've treated this country for the last 50 years as their own private plantation. But there's got to be a lot of sense of revenge on the part of those who have been murdered and who have been brutalized by 50 years of Assad's Muhabarat, his vicious secret police, and the more recent killings of up to 50,000 people. You're suggesting no revenge, no retribution?
No, not by any stretch of the imagination. There, I'm sure, will be revenge killings. I'm sure there will be retribution. But I do believe that with adequate support from the international community, we can help people process actually prosecutions in a courts of law. I think we can be better positioned to distinguish between those with blood on their hands and those who had no choice but to support the regime out of fear for their own lives and their families' lives. I do want to clarify one thing. The Alawi community in Syria is deeply divided over Assad, with a great many Alawis refusing to accept him as a leader. Assad himself has proven that he is non-sectarian in that he targets anybody and everybody who stands in his way. He has jailed and killed hundreds, if not thousands, of Alawis. The same applies to our Christian Syrians and the Druze and the Kurds. And so really what you have is a popular revolution that in which the there was at one time a silent majority. Many of those Syrian silents were made up of minority communities, but I think that balance has shifted tremendously in the last few weeks.
So you don't expect a Balkanized Syria where the Alawis retreat to their ancestral mountains and the country is divided and broken up?
Well, certainly that is always a possibility, but I really don't think it will happen. For one thing, Syrians are united in their desire for the Assad regime to go away and to implement a system of democracy. Second of all, I don't think an Alawite state could be sustainable by any means. I mean, how would they defend themselves? They would be a tiny sliver of a country. And I think the vast majority of Syrians don't want to see their country divided any more so than Assad has already divided it.
So, Rafish Jujadi, again, the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committee, is the umbrella group of activists inside of Syria. When we see footage of the Free Syrian Army, and they've definitely been under-equipped, under-armed, and against a very, very powerful military, which they seem to have gradually been eroding the power of the Assad military machine. Nevertheless, the footage we see of the fighters usually are young guys, often with the kind of the beard, which is a symbol of the jihadis, if you will, shouting Allah Akbar. So what's going on here? Is that selective use of footage or is that something that we should be alarmed about in the sense that the vanguard of the Free Syrian Army appear to be these young Islamists?
Well, it's maybe a yes and yes type of answer. Now, for one thing, on the very surface of it, the Free Syrian Army fighters don't necessarily have access to razors, nor do they have time to be shaving and grooming. They are fighting against a regime that has declared war on its own people. Now, there are jihadists inside Syria. Many of them are foreigners who have come in and are trying to declare Islamic jihad. So we cannot deny the fact that these people are present. We also cannot deny the fact that their agenda is very different from that of the Syrian people. So while these groups have taken up arms and while they are organized and fighting alongside the Free Syrian Army. We also know that the vast majority of Syrians do not want this and far outnumber any Islamic jihadists. Syrians, by nature, are relatively secular. I would say the majority are moderate conservatives, but with full respect for other religious communities, with full respect for the law. So these Islamic jihadists who are there now, I think, pose a danger initially, but I think they will clear out. In terms of the footage of men with beards, again, they don't necessarily have the time to engage in personal grooming, and many may be simply responding to the desires of their funders. The Free Syrian Army is going to turn to whichever government funds them and provides them with the weapons they need. And so if the call is for some Islamist state, they may very well respond to that simply to achieve their goals, which is to topple the Assad regime.
So are you saying, Rashid Shujadi, that since a lot of the sponsorship comes from Saudi Arabia, which is a fairly fundamentalist regime, is that what the Saudis want? Do they want a pluralistic, free Syria, or do they want a regime like the one they have in Saudi Arabia that's dominated by the Wahhabi religious sect?
Well, I think the funding that's coming from Saudi Arabia that specifically supports Islamist groups comes from individuals and not necessarily the Saudi government. With regard to Saudi interests in Syria, I don't believe the Saudis want to impose a form of government, but I do believe they are committed to seeing the overthrow of the Assad regime.
And as you were saying earlier, Rafif Shahjadi, you think that's happening. I mean, I've talked to a lot of U.S. experts on Syria, and they've suggested that this could take a long time, and this will be a very painful and brutal reckoning because of the nature of the Assad regime and because of the fact that, frankly, the West has been very reluctant to arm the Free Syrian Army, and none of the major powers have really stepped forth, although the French appear to be moving in that direction. So just in closing, you're suggesting this is happening pretty much now, that this regime may be on its last legs. So has the fact that the West hasn't really supported the Free Syrian Army, do you think that the West will pay a price? Is there a lot of bitterness towards the West in terms of the sacrifices that the Free Syrian Army have had to make in this asymmetrical battle that they've engaged in?
Well, certainly there's a fair amount of bitterness. I mean, Syrians have been shouting and literally dying for freedom, dignity, human rights. These are more or less Western concepts. And the very perpetrators of those Western concepts are not stepping up to help them. So certainly there is some level of bitterness. I think what this means is after the liberation of Syria is perhaps diminished influence in the region. And it's a shame because Syrians were calling for what we in the West enjoy as a matter of fact. And I think the international community has had tremendous opportunities to help guide or shape the future of Syria in responding to what Syrians want. With regard to this being a long and messy, protracted crisis, yes, some aspects will be long. Transition is never clean. But I think overwhelmingly Syrians want to transition to a stable and secure country where they are all equals under the law, where there is a system of democracy, where there is not a system of nepotism and cronyism. And I think eventually the will of the Syrian people will be realized.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Rafif Shahjadi.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Rafif Shahjadi, who is the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, the umbrella group of activists inside Syria. She's a Syrian-American activist in the Washington, D.C. area, and the Syrian Local Coordination Committees help organize protests, workshops, and other events designed to empower other activists to take action and inform the public about events inside of Syria. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the bogus fiscal cliff.
يلا ارحل يا بشار
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeff Madrick, the author of Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. Jeff Madrick is a journalist, economic policy consultant, and analyst, and he writes a column on economics for Harper's and currently edits Challenge magazine and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books, the New York Times, and other publications. He's the author of such critically acclaimed books as Taking America, The End of Affluence, and The Case for Big Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff.
Good to be back.
And the Republicans have come up with a counteroffer on this so-called fiscal cliff. On the Sunday talk shows, Senator Lindsey Graham said we've already gone over the fiscal cliff. I can't believe that everybody's going along with this apocalyptic framing of this situation, which, by the way, is a situation we're in because of Republican intransigence and the insane antics of the Tea Party back when they threatened the full faith and credit of the United States and brought about this mechanism of the sequester. So,
I completely agree with you. It's not as if this is some natural disaster imposed on us as an act of nature. This was imposed on us because the right-wing Republicans stubbornly held to the idea that, first of all, there was that debt ceiling that they kept threatening America with, that they wouldn't approve taking on any more debt. And secondly, this extreme notion of austerity, that we've got to manage the federal budget deficit immediately. And they came to this agreement that the super committee would negotiate and cut the deficit that they thought was so necessary. They wanted to cut it too sharply. They couldn't agree. Now there are automatic cuts in spending, on top of which there are going to be automatic tax increases because so much will be expiring on January 1st. It's pretty close to insane.
Well, predictably, I suppose, the Republican counteroffer is a $2.2 trillion package with $600 billion in federal health programs being cut and a decrease in the cost of living adjustments to Social Security. So they appear to be going after what little social safety net we have here in the United States compared to the rest of the social democracies. And they want to extend the tax cuts for the rich and keep them in place. So there we have the dynamics, right? Obama wants the rich to pay a little more, and they want to cut more from the working Americans in the middle class.
Well, there's no question. That's the showdown. The showdown is, do we tax ourselves more, especially the rich, or do we cut Social Security and Medicare more, not to mention some other programs like Medicaid, which is already dismally inadequate. So that is the showdown. Now, I think the question is, Obama is probably prepared to cut Medicare some, and maybe Social Security as well. The question is how much and what kind, and will he stick to his guns? The Republicans, in turn, may stick to their guns. So that's why we call it a showdown. And if they do, Ian, they will, if nothing happens, if no agreement is made well into 2013, 3.5% or 4% of buying power, of GDP buying power, will be subtracted from the economy, and that could easily lead to a serious recession. In fact, it almost certainly will.
Well, then, Jeff Madrick, that's the point, isn't it? That we're having the wrong conversation here. The whole country's having the wrong conversation about this so-called fiscal cliff. The sky is falling. Most of it's being generated, by the way. This alarm over deficits is being generated by Wall Street billionaires, for God's sake. And here we are talking about how much we're going to depress an already faltering economy. Why aren't we talking about more stimulus? I mean, there's a little bit of stimulus in what Obama's offering, but that should be what the conversation's about.
Well, I agree. My first column, I think, for Harper's Magazine was the austerity myth. There is an old pre-Depression classical economic argument that if you just let everything collapse, it will eventually bounce back. if you let wages fall, if you let interest rates fall, capital investment and so forth, it will hit a natural floor and come bouncing back. Of course, there are two big problems with that. It entails enormous pain, number one, and in fact, it undermines future economic growth because we stop investing ourselves, educating ourselves. We stop investing in equipment and new ideas and new managerial methods. We lose confidence in general, and that's much more important in an economy where there is so much more global competition. So it's a pretty harrowing idea, and it was one that was clearly proved incorrect by the Great Depression. It keeps coming back, this classical kind of economics, and I shouldn't even entirely call it classical, but this conservative classical economics keeps coming back, and that's more a sociological and political question than it is has anything to do with economic science, in my view. And a lot of it has to do with the power of vested interests now and the blindness they have towards their own good over the long run. It's quite a time we live in. I'd say austerity is the most dangerous, outside of international diplomatic issues, the most dangerous idea in the world today.
So would it be possible then, Jeff Madrick, to change the debate? And I know the White House is committed to making the rich pay more, and that was he campaigned on it, and that's the line that he's drawing, and the Republicans are saying, no, the rich shouldn't pay more, the poor middle class should lose benefits. Why not change the debate and say to the rich, okay, you've done better than ever, you're sitting on piles of money, we won't tax you, but you got to step up and improve the lives of the entire country, not just accrue more and more wealth and have more and more yachts and extra homes in the Hamptons, etc. Why not make a call to economic patriotism?
Because it won't work, Ian. You can't underestimate how these people deceive themselves, these very rich people. They actually think they are economic patriots. They have convinced themselves that they are, or many of them have convinced themselves. I think some are just utterly cynical and know better, that they are economic patriots, that they are the job creators, that if you make profit and create a good business and you have low taxes, you will create the greatest wealth. There is absolutely no historical evidence to demonstrate that. There are some economists, even at places like Harvard, who claim it is true. They've almost all been rebutted by equally good or if not better economists with more objective empirical information to show that low taxes do not lead to faster economic growth. The fact is we need social programs not only for social justice and decency, but to maintain enough demand in the economy to create business sales and therefore profits and jobs and incentives to invest. And that we've gotten away from that is tragic. That we've lost the sense of how economies really work is tragic. And I blame economists a lot for this, who bought into this neoclassical idea. Even economists who used to think of themselves as liberal and sometimes claim they still are, they bought into a very narrow view of how economies work. And that, too, is a sociological issue, I think, related to where the payoff is, both in ambition and government jobs and consulting fees and so forth.
So if the wealthy in this country have had it so good, think that they are really economic patriots while they pay 15% and carried interest and the rest of us pay more taxes, and the continual financialization of the economy takes place where Wall Street controls more and more of our economy and the CEOs basically buy back stock to make themselves richer, but don't invest in plant and equipment and R&D. And so in a macro sense, we have an economy based on the extraction of wealth, not on the creation of wealth. And that's not sustainable. And that seems to me to be the conversation that maybe we should be having. That's what the president should be warning about, is and putting these guys on notice that Gordon Gekko may have said that greed is good, but unbridled greed is going to be bad for all.
Well, it's already been bad. We've had an enormous financial crisis, mostly because of that. A lot of what you're describing is the financialization of the economy. Companies like Mitt Romney's Bain and Company. That was the classic example of extracting wealth rather than creating wealth. I mean, there were some exceptions, but for the most part, that's what those kind of privatizing companies did. A lot of this emanated, a lot of the problems emanated from Wall Street, this determination to reduce capital investment in new ideas, and labor costs, all to pay off debt that was borrowed to buy these companies and then sell them at ridiculous profits to a handful of individuals. So, yeah, I agree, but I think the president just talking about it is not going to be able to manage to do that. It would also be nice if the media took on more responsibility. They just don't. They accept the Simpson-Bowles plan as if it's common sense and a middle ground. It's just outrageous. So the influences are all around us, and, you know, some of us, you know, I run a project called Rediscovering Government out of the Roosevelt Institute, and we try to change the public discourse on some of that. And after all, the president did win handily against a guy from Central Casting on the other side, an African-American man, won with an 8% unemployment rate against this guy from Central Casting. So something is going on. Whether it's enough, I'd love to say it's enough. I'm dubious, but something is going on here. People are angry, and the president is holding a harder line, towing, I should say, a tougher line against the Republicans so far. He's asking for more tax revenues than he did last year in negotiations. And I hope he continues to do that and puts them on the spot. I think this is a tough time. Unfortunately, we may all pay a price for a showdown.
Just in closing, Jeff Madrick, clearly the deficit is being increased largely because of the inflation involved on the medical sector. And, of course, defense is in the sequester that could be cut as well. And that certainly would not be the end of the world if we were back at 2007 spending. But my understanding is that a so-called Obamacare is going to do a lot to reduce the increasing inflation in medical costs, which are now around 80-90% of GDP. The rest of the advanced world get by with about half of that. So is that going to change the landscape? Again, it's not what the president's talking about.
Well, I'm a little more optimistic about Obamacare than you are, Ian.
No, I'm not being pessimistic. I'm saying he's got a case to make there, saying that it's going to actually, the real problem in terms of driving the deficit are the outrageous medical costs in this country, and we're going to contain them.
Your listeners should understand that very clearly. Costs are not going to increase very much as a percentage of GDP, but Medicare and Medicaid costs are. And the main reason, I'm just repeating what you said, will be the rapid increase in health care costs. This is not happening immediately, people should know. We don't have to deal with this in the next 5 to 7, even the next, to be frank, it's really not going to hit for 15 years. That's what's so aggravating about this fiscal cliff talk. But it is going to hit unless we seriously begin to get health care costs under control. I hope Obamacare will lead to more programs that can reduce those health care costs. But it's another one of these bits of insanity of late. We pay so much more per person for health care and get no more from it. And I'm increasingly beginning to think the healthcare system is near the bottom of the rich countries now, not in the middle, because access is so much more difficult than it used to do. Access to your family practitioner, access to the best specialists. If you're on Medicare, it's increasingly difficult to get, at least in New York City, the best doctors to look at you. It's very disturbing that we are still the richest nation in the world, and we don't act like it whatsoever. If you lived through Hurricane Sandy here in New York City, you would be doubly reminded that we act like a poor country. We've got to invest in ourselves, and we have a very low tax rate, much lower than our OECD, our rich country competitors and colleagues.
All of whom have
a lot of room to raise taxes.
All of whom have comprehensive and universal health care for all of their citizens. I thank you for joining us, Jeff Madrick.
It's always a pleasure, Ian. Thank you. Take care now.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Madrick, who's the author of Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the President. Jeff Madrick's a journalist, economic policy consultant, and analyst, and he writes a column on economics for Harper's and currently edits Challenge magazine and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books and the New York Times. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about Hillary Clinton running for president. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Stephen Walt, who is the Robert and Rene Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy. And he also co-wrote with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Walt.
Nice to be with you, Ian.
And there's an article or a blog by David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, that's getting a lot of attention. Hillary is running, a dispatch from the Saban Forum. The Saban Forum took place in Washington a few days ago, three-day conference with a lot of senior Israeli officials, including the foreign minister, Lieberman, who was interviewed on stage by NPR's Robert Siegel. And it's a love fest that Hillary and company and the Israeli lobby are having. And the suggestion is that she's running for president. And I guess, is this the first step in running for president?
Well, certainly when I read the transcript of her remarks, my first conclusion I came to was that it was exactly that, that this is the first step in at least preparing the ground for a possible run in 2016. And certainly she was not going to do or say anything that might undermine her chances down the road. You know, she may want to take some time to think this through, and a lot can happen in the next 4 years. But I think it was a speech and, in fact, indeed an event that shows you just how unusual and in some respects unhealthy the current U.S.-Israeli relationship is, both unhealthy for the United States, but as Remnick, I think, makes clear, although he does it rather indirectly, is also not healthy for Israel either.
But it is extraordinary, is it not, that if you want to run for president of the United States, your first priority is, in effect, to start with Jerusalem.
Well, certainly, if you're Hillary, you're going to want to make sure that you have solid support from the so-called Israel lobby. And, you know, Chaim Sabin, who is the founder of the Sabin Center at the Brookings Institution and is also, I believe, still the single largest donor to the Democratic Party over the last 10 years or so, you want to make sure that you have that kind of support lined up in advance. And as you say, her speech, which was on the record, is something of a love fest. It repeats most of the usual Israeli talking points about the peace process, blames the lack of progress almost entirely on the Palestinians, was extraordinarily gentle, sort of chided the Israelis that maybe they should be somewhat more generous. and spoke, of course, with great warmth about all of her personal contacts and personal gratitude to Israeli officials and also to Mr. Sabin himself. So it was an event designed, I think, to solidify her credentials there. Unfortunately, of course, this was happening immediately after Israel had announced it was going to build a whole new series of settlements in an area known as E1, which will further bifurcate any possible Palestinian state and, again, puts the two-state solution that the United States proclaims as its goal even further out of reach than ever.
Well, Dr. Stephen Wald, it does seem extraordinary, though, that this very right-wing Foreign Minister Lieberman, from a former bouncer from Moldova in the former USSR, was given such kid glove treatment. And he, of course, lives in a settlement. And it does seem that this announcement of these new settlements is something of a poke in the eye to the president, is it not? I mean, this is longstanding U.S. policy, and yet every now and then, Israel decides to go ahead and defy the world, and they've just done it again.
That's right. And, of course, President Obama has been poked in the eye numerous times since he became president. And remember, he began in 2009 by saying, if we're going to have a peace process, it ought to begin with a halt to the settlements so we can negotiate an agreement once and for all. And, of course, that was completely rejected by the Israelis, and they've done a number of other things subsequently to poke him. Whenever that happens, a spokesman goes out, says that this is contrary to U.S. policy, that we think it's not helpful and not constructive, but nothing further happens. We offer some meaningless words and then do nothing. At this point, there's no reason to think the Netanyahu government has any respect for what the Obama administration might do. And I think those who might have believed that the United States would finally get serious in an Obama second term are now discovering that that's not going to be the case. And if Hillary does run for president in 2016 and she does get elected, she will then get to deal with this problem because it won't have been solved. It will just have gotten worse.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Wald, who is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and he co-wrote with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. The Remnick article at The New Yorker, again, he attended this private function, the Sabam Forum, 3 days of conference in Washington, D.C. over this weekend. And many of the top Israeli officials, including the foreign minister, spoke. What was interesting, though, that the only dissident voice in this love fest was the former Likud Prime Minister Olmert, who really went after Netanyahu. I mean, he's turning out to be, even though he's been somewhat disgraced with convictions, etc., in Israeli politics, which often the political battles often extend into the courts, it seems. But it does seem that he's actually, you know, standing up and basically saying that Netanyahu is a disaster for Israel.
Well, this is a position, by the way, that is not new for Olmert. He's been saying things like this since he was prime minister. Back in 2007, he gave a famous interview to Haaretz newspaper in Israel where he said that if the two-state solution fails, Israel's future is bleak. It will face a long-term struggle for political rights similar to what happened in South Africa. And then he went on to say that if that ever happens, the state of Israel's finished. So he's been sounding the alarm on this front. The problem, as Remnick's very important article makes clear, is that Olmert doesn't have really any following in Israel now. He's not personally popular. He doesn't lead a large and popular party. And the real problem here is it's not just Netanyahu. It's not just Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister. It's the entire direction that Israeli domestic politics is going. Remnick talks about how Israeli politics has become quite dysfunctional, even perhaps more dysfunctional than American politics, if that's possible. But the other issue is that the Israeli political opinion has been drifting steadily rightward. There really isn't a powerful peace movement in Israel any longer, and there's no immediate consequences for that because the United States will continue to support them no matter what they do. The result of which is that ultimately they will end up with one state, and then they'll have the problem of eventually the Palestinian population under their control will be a majority. And this is the future that Olmert is warning against, but there's no political consensus in Israel to do anything about it, and there's no political consensus here in the United States to try and encourage that process in any meaningful way. I think that's why you get him get Olmert being increasingly concerned about this and increasingly outspoken. But what you don't hear is a way of solving the problem.
Well, that's pretty extraordinary, though. It feels like Back to the Future here, that Dr. Stephen Walt. That my understanding is that the two-state solution, starting with the Oslo Accords, was largely pushed for, and I remember at the time talking to a lot of senior Israeli generals and intelligence people. They were the ones that pushed the two-state solution along with the Yitzhak Rabin in the first place, not out of any altruism towards the Palestinians, but out of an understanding that the demographic time bomb was ticking, and then unless there were two states, Israel would be overwhelmed demographically by the Palestinians. So here we are, and I don't understand. What do you think is Netanyahu and the right wing? And, you know, you're correct in suggesting, and Remnick does in the article, that the Israeli electorate has moved far to the right. And, in fact, former President Bill Clinton said that this is a result of the emigration from the former Soviet Union, and that Israel, you know, its political center has changed forever and it's gone rightward. What is Netanyahu's thinking? What is their end game?
I'm not sure they have an endgame. I mean, certainly Netanyahu's objective is to deny the Palestinians any meaningful statehood. That's been his clear position throughout his political career. He would like Israel to control all of Mandate Palestine, all of the West Bank. And he finally, in 2009, conceded that there might they might allow the existence of a sort of quasi-state, a series of independent Palestinian communities that would be completely surrounded by Israeli territory, completely under Israeli control. And if the Palestinians maybe someday agreed to that, we could call it a state. But this is not a meaningful statehood. This is just apartheid by another name. The problem is I don't know what Netanyahu sees as the long-term blueprint or how you get there, how you avoid the problem that Olmert and others have pointed to. And therefore you have what I regard as a tragedy in the making, where basically it will be impossible to sustain a democratic and Jewish state in all of Mandate Palestine, and yet it will also be impossible to create two states for two peoples, which has been the stated objective. And sooner or later, the United States is going to have to confront the fact that what it has declared to be its goal, two states for two peoples, is simply no longer possible. But we're not at that point yet, which is why, again, Hillary Clinton can stand up in front of the Sabin Forum and say what she said without recognizing that that's probably an outdated view and one that is not going to be tenable for too much longer.
And one that she will inherit, a worsening situation.
Might. If she were at some point down the road to become president, then, you know, having helped kick the can down the road another 4 years, she will be facing an even more difficult set of challenges.
And at this Saban Forum over the weekend in Washington, D.C., that David Remnick writes about in The New Yorker, Hillary is running a dispatch from the Saban Forum. Apparently, the only Palestinian voice there was Salam Fayyad, the prime minister of the Palestinian Authority. And, of course, the Palestinian Authority have just been castrated, if that's possible, to multiple castrations. I'm not sure that that's medically possible, but it feels that that's what's happened to the Palestinian Authority. They've been made almost entirely irrelevant. And now the political shift inside Palestine is moving towards Hamas, even though they're essentially religious fundamentalists and zealots, as the word Hamas means, zealot or zeal. They're making the authority even more irrelevant. What's the point of the Palestinian Authority now?
Well, I think there's two ways to view it. One is that this is simply a short-sighted policy on Israel's part, that they, with the Oslo Accords, they finally had a legitimate set of Palestinian leaders who were willing to make peace. They wanted to bargain over what that peace would be like, as anyone would, but they had accepted Israel's right to exist. And, of course, Israel was far stronger, so it was in a position where it could grant the Palestinians a state of their own and then live in peace. That didn't work. And instead, over the next now almost 20 years, the number of Israeli settlers more than doubled, so that there are now over 500,000 Israelis living in the territory that is supposed to be part of a Palestinian state. The result of that, of course, has been to completely discredit the Palestinian Authority. If 20 years of trying to reach a peaceful settlement doesn't work, and the settlements keep growing, what's the point? And that inevitably strengthens extremists on the other side. So one argument would be the Israelis have just been very short-sighted. A second argument, and it's more cynical, would be that this is actually something they're not unhappy about. That, in fact, although they don't much like Hamas, particularly now, having Hamas as the enemy makes it easier to rally American support, makes it more likely that the Europeans won't put a lot of pressure on them, that in a sense having a very weak Palestinian Authority and a very dangerous, or what looks dangerous, Hamas bogeyman is perfect because it allows the settlement project to continue. The reason why that is also short-sighted is that it ultimately doesn't do anything about the larger demographic problem that Israel faces as long as it continues to control the West Bank and as long as it continues to exert what is in effect de facto control over Gaza.
Well, the origins of Hamas are somewhat peculiar because I think it was Shin Bet, the Israeli equivalent of the FBI, that was secretly funded Hamas in the beginning as a hedge against Arafat and the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, back then. So I don't know how much of their fingerprints are over Hamas. Obviously, they are mortal enemies. But is that a continuation of that kind of cynical policy, that this is almost like, you know, buying a guard dog as a puppy and it's a sweet little thing, and then when it grows up, you know, it becomes the master and you become the servant, and this is the monster that's gotten out of control?
Well, I think what it reflects is a failure to realize that Israel's own interests have changed. Back when Israel was being founded, when Zionism was first underway, or even for many years after Israel was founded, it was in Israel's interest, in at least the short term, to promote Palestinian disunity, to keep the Palestinians divided, quarreling amongst themselves, not allow strong, competent leaders to emerge. Because they might cause more trouble for Israel. Once the Palestinians had accepted Israel's existence, which again Yasser Arafat did with the Oslo Accords, then it was in fact in Israel's interest to start building up a competent, legitimate, popular authority within the Palestinian population, to do everything it could to strengthen the people who had accepted Israel's existence and to marginalize the extremists. And I think the Israeli government, you could even argue the Israeli political system broadly defined, never made that big conceptual shift, that shift away from constantly wanting to keep the Palestinians divided to a situation where you actually wanted to strengthen them. Because if you really were interested in two states for two peoples, you would want the Palestinian state next door to be very well run, very well governed, with a popular, legitimate authority that knew how to manage things. And I'm afraid that the only thing the Israelis have really been interested in has been a Palestinian security force that would keep order in the West Bank so they didn't have to do it, but not in allowing a truly strong, capable, legitimate Palestinian leadership and political community to emerge. And I think, again, that's unfortunately short-sighted, and we see it the difficulties being manifest all the time.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Stephen Walt, you know, the former Israeli Likud Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who was the only dissident voice at this Saban Center love fest that David Remnick writes about in The New Yorker, critical of Netanyahu and of Israel's direction, and particularly making the analogy with it between Israel and South Africa, which is something that the Israelis really do not like to hear. There is an analogy, though, isn't there? There's never been a Palestinian Mandela, and I think you're right in suggesting that that's not what the Israelis wanted ever. But that's what the situation really requires now. And we know from the South African example that the short-sighted attitude of the Afrikaners in maintaining apartheid way after the historical clock made it acceptable has led to the very problems that South Africa had. You know, a whole generation of young Africans weren't educated because they were in rebellion. And I see a lot of analogies there with you've got a whole generation of young Palestinians, which is in effect, it's a young state at any rate, demographically, that are unemployed and angry. I mean, you know, but a lot of people have said that America's policy towards Israel is a policy of assisted suicide. And I'm afraid it looks that way.
Yeah, I think that, you know, ironically, when to just take this back full circle, what Hillary Clinton was doing at the Sabin Center was attempting to present herself as a great friend of the Jewish state. And I think unintentionally, of course, speeches like hers and the general policy of benevolent tolerance is ultimately not an act of friendship. That if you feel a friend is headed on the wrong path, you should be doing everything in your power to try and get them off that path and onto a better one. And by essentially serving as the enabler for a set of policies that we claim to object to, the United States, and in this case the Secretary of State, was not acting like a true friend.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Stephen Walt.
Nice talking with you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Walt, who is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of The Origins of Alliance, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, the Global Response to U.S. Primacy. And he also co-wrote with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and answer some of your questions of late. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down.